Once we saw that there was this buy-in, and like I said before, we got the data, it was really pretty easy to convince everyone that mental health had to become a priority. You take a typical college student athlete, they focus on their athletics, their academics, their social life, and you can't do everything, so what's the one thing they skimp on? And that's sleep. We have to put mental health in the same realm of physical health. They're really inseparable, but let's treat any mental health symptom like we would treat an ankle sprain, and then we'll be on the right path if we do that.
All right, everyone, welcome to another edition of the Tennis Worthy Podcast, brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I am Patrick McEnroe, the president of the Tennis Hall of Fame. And this month, we've got something a little bit different for you. You know, we concentrate, obviously, on the Hall of Famers, on tennis-specific topics like competitiveness, mental toughness. But what about mental health overall? Well, we've got one of the experts on that topic here. Very happy to welcome him, Dr. Brian Hainlein, who's been studying this his entire life, also an avid tennis player, and also happens to play at my hometown club in beautiful Douglasson, Queens, New York. Please welcome Dr. Brian Hainlein to Tennis Worthy.
Great to be here with you, Patrick, and thanks.
Thank you for being here. I want to start with this because, we in the tennis world talk so much about the great players, right? And the great matches and the great tournaments. And that's a lot of what this podcast is about, celebrating the Hall of Famers. But this topic of mental health has become, you know, more and more out front and more important in the last couple of years. You've been part of the group of people spearheading that with your role as the president of USA. I know you've studied this your whole professional career as well. Why has this become a topic that is now becoming okay for us to talk about?
Yeah, it's a great question, Patrick. And a lot of it is because the stigma has started to go away. You know, you had a couple of people in particular, Michael Phelps in the Olympic world, and then Naomi Osaka, who basically stood up and said, look, we're really struggling. I mean, Michael went to the point that he said, you know, I had really dark thoughts. I wanted to kill myself. And so when you have these great athletes that are speaking about it, and look, we're all human beings. Everyone has dark thoughts, and sometimes we go into a dark corner. And so it's just part of life. And so what happened, once the stigma was reduced, people started feeling more comfortable talking about it. But another important thing happened. You know, coaches are incredibly data-driven. You know, I worked with college coaches a lot when I was with the NCAA. And when we started showing the coaches data that mental health disorders actually predict injury, they predict poor performance, the coaches started listening and said, hey, we better start allowing our athletes to be treated for mental health, just like we make certain they get treated for an ankle sprain.
Yeah, now you spent, I think, over a decade, right, as the chief medical officer of NCAA. What was that like from the standpoint of getting the coaches and the administrations of these big universities to buy into, yeah, we're going to spend some money, we're going to do the research, we're going to devote some time and energy into looking at this?
Well, it's interesting. It started off my very first week on the job. It's what's called the NCAA convention, which is basically their annual meeting. And I met with the Division I, Division II, and Division III Student Athlete Advisory Committee members, the National Committee members. And they all said to me, look, Dr. Hainlein, we get concussion because, you know, I'm a neurologist. And they said, but can you please make mental health your priority? So the student athletes were already way ahead of the game. But then it was working with the football coaches. And I remember in particular Nick Saban, who was then coach of University of Alabama. And I visited his school and he said, Doc, look, I want you to tell me everything you know about mental health and sleep. So Saban was one step ahead of the game. But once we saw that there was this buy-in, and like I said before, we got the data, it was really pretty easy to convince everyone that mental health had to become a priority.
You know, it's funny you mentioned sleep because I spent last weekend visiting my daughter, who's a sophomore at Duke University. She played quite a bit of junior tennis, but not playing now. But one of the things I did was go listen to the president of Duke speak. You know, it was one of the things that the parents could do. And my wife and I took our daughter. And at the end of his talk, where he talked about the academics, the athletics of the university, you know, the new world of the NIL, the moderator asked him what was the one single thing that he'd like to leave with. And he said, "We all need more sleep." And I and it's funny because I turned to my wife and my daughter and I said, "See, your mom and dad weren't that off." And I have twins that are 16 now that are juniors. So try to get them to sleep. But what? I mean, I think we know why it's so important. But how have we lost the mark in sending that message to our kids in this new generation?
Well, it's been a couple of things. Once, you know, first of all, younger kids, what we call emerging adults, because even in college, you aren't labeled an adult yet. You're an emerging adult. You know, we all think at that age that we're invincible. And so you take a typical college student athlete, they focus on their athletics, their academics, their social life, now NIL. And you can't do everything. So what's the one thing they skimp on? And that's sleep. But the data on sleep are absolutely amazing. So when I was in medical school, you know, you may have heard of the lymphatic system, you know, it kind of drains the body. So now there's a glymphatic system. It's in the brain. We just discovered that a few years ago. And when you're in a very deep restorative phase of sleep, what we used to call phase four, that's when the glymphatic system is working maximally. And so all of our recovery happens during our deep sleep. But there's some other interesting data. If you're sleep deprived or have a sleep disorder, that predicts a musculoskeletal injury more than overtraining does. You think about that. I mean, someone has an acute injury or, you know, a chronic injury, and we never ask them how much are you sleeping. And there's some other interesting data that sleep disorders actually predict suicidal thoughts, suicidal ideation. Sleep disorders predict poor performance. There's one really great study. They looked at tennis players, collegiate tennis players, those who were sleep deprived and those who weren't. And the accuracy of the serve was far greater in those who were not sleep deprived. So sleep is critical. And when we look at injuries, when you're sleep deprived after an injury, your recovery rate is much worse. So yeah, sleep is a critical element here.
I've got my Whoop here, you know, so that tells me when I'm not getting enough sleep and maybe I shouldn't have that extra cocktail or two at night as well. So that's another story for another day. But how did you, I'm intrigued by your journey because I know you're a regular player. You play a lot competitive tennis, but how did you get into this type of work? I mean, obviously, where'd you go to med school, by the way?
University of Chicago.
University of Chicago. Okay. So when you were in med school, were you already thinking of neurology and then, you know, this type of study is what you wanted to do? Or, and then obviously fast forward to how mental health and particularly performance related to sports became one of your real interests in your profession.
Well, when I went to medical school, I actually went there to become a psychiatrist. You know, at Notre Dame, where I did my undergrad, I did a year independent study on Carl Jung. And I said, oh, man, I want to be like Carl Jung, you know, and understand the collective unconsciousness and all that stuff. But in med school, you know, psychiatry was sort of really in the midst of a psychopharmacologic revolution, kind of like treating the brain like a beaker. You add a little bit of this and a little bit of that and you shake it. And it made no sense to me. And, you know, I'm dating myself, but when I was in med school, that's when CAT scans first came out. So we're actually looking at the brain in three-dimensional elements. And it was such an emerging field, it just sort of exploded. So that was one thing. Although, you know, there's another part, and I don't talk about it that often, but, you know, when I was at Notre Dame my junior year and I was on a scholarship, I actually quit the tennis team. And I didn't realize why at the time, but as it turns out, I was profoundly depressed. And I didn't want to tell anyone. I kind of, you know, I was lucky in many ways. I worked through it, came back my senior year, played number one in singles and doubles. But that was a long, long, lonely journey. You know, you lose your scholarship, people walk away from you. And so that sparked it a little bit. But then it was, you know, I got to work with a lot of the Olympic athletes as well. And the International Olympic Committee asked me to be co-chair of their first ever summit on mental health and elite athletes. And that was just so mind-opening. And we published our first consensus paper in 2019, and we're in the midst of redoing it right now. So we're going to have a new world consensus on mental health and elite athletes published in the spring of 2026. So kind of a few things pushed me in that direction. And again, not the least of which were the student athletes at the NCAA.
You know, it's interesting because when I hear you talk about that as a junior in college, and I go back to my days playing junior tennis. And of course, at our tennis academy here in New York with my brother, you know, I'm dealing with a lot of parents and a lot of kids. But one of the things that we always discussed, you know, as kids, you know, when I was 14, 15 playing Eastern tennis, was that, you know, when you talk about other players, hey, this guy's really mentally tough. Right. So that was sort of a code word. Right. I mean, you could enlighten us a little bit more on that. You know, if someone wasn't mentally tough, they were soft, or, you know, you didn't, like you said, you didn't want to talk about it. You were a junior in college, you were a bit older. So how important is it that most of us are at least able to talk about? You mentioned Naomi Osaka. I think of Marty Fish, you know, pulling out of his big match with Roger Federer at the U.S. Open, round of 16 match. And how is it now that, you know, there's still some issues with it, right? But it's much more out in the open now that being strong mentally is also, you know, means something a little bit different now, doesn't it?
Well, it really does. And sort of two things have happened. One is this field of really mental toughness. And Jim Lehrer, you know, of course, is, I think, the modern day father of really epitomizing what mental toughness is. And that's sort of a frame of mind where you always are able to live in the present and you're just incredibly competitive and you know how not to lose that edge. That's not mental health alone, because mental health really is the ups and downs of feeling depressed or anxious, or sometimes you're just feeling like in an optimal state. And what's new is that the licensed mental health providers, so psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, they're talking to the mental toughness coaches, because we realize those are not two separate worlds. And you can be really mentally tough, but if you have a full-blown anxiety disorder or you're starting to be clinically depressed, the mental toughness just doesn't work anymore, because you become overwhelmed. It's sort of like being in a state of profound hunger or thirst. I mean, you have to address it. And that's the other thing we understand, is that mental health symptoms and disorders, that's core physiology. That's not somewhere out in the clouds or in a mystical place. It really is the essence of who we are.
We know this as tennis players, right? Particularly in tennis, it's such an individual sport. I mean, we were both lucky enough to play in college, and you know, that was one of the great experiences for me to kind of be part of a team. I love team sports as a kid. But tennis is a very lonely game, right? You're out there on your own. You've got to deal with all these issues yourself, in addition to, you know, if I'm first serve going in, or, you know, how am I hitting my forehand? So what are the things, and you've studied the other Olympic sports as well. So obviously there's swimming, gymnastics, you know, Simone Biles and her story is one that fascinated all of us. But what makes the individual sports, particularly tennis, a unique challenge?
Well, it's interesting. You kind of, you know, the emerging literature is that we sort of self-select what sport we go into, and we broadly categorize what we call team sports and then the individual sports. And so the type of people who will go into tennis or will go into swimming or, you know, go into fencing and you know, they have a certain attitude where they just don't mind being alone. In fact, they actually like that sort of frame of reference. And so, you know, by self-selecting, you're taking certain people who are able to excel from that point of view. But the emerging data also tell us that the individual sports, that those athletes have a higher incidence of mental health symptoms and disorders than those who play group sports or team sports. And it's interesting, you know, you think about it, you know, you mentioned the team, and I think there's a big difference between playing on your college tennis team, you know, and your buddies are there, they're supporting you, you travel together. That really is a team sport. But when you're out on the tour, it's very different. And so having that built-in support system is really critical.
Let me ask you this, because I struggled with this in my years with the USTA, and I know you, I don't know if you did or not, but I want to ask you about it, because I feel that what you just mentioned, like the team part of tennis, we lose it a little bit with our juniors, you know, because they start playing tennis, we have team competitions for the young kids, and usually as they get to be, you know, higher level, where that individual part comes in, and I feel that we lose a lot of kids that want to be part of a team, but, you know, because high school tennis in some places is popular, but it's not really the same as other sports, that we lose a lot of kids because they get morphed away from a team environment. and more in an individual environment. I guess my question is, how can we all, because I know the USA has been trying to do this for years, how can we all in the tennis world improve upon that?
Yeah, I think we look at the models, especially at the ITF. I think at the world level, they do it better than in the USTA. Look at the 10Us, the 12Us team competitions. Those are awesome. And you follow the kids that are doing that, they're having a ball. And we can keep that model going. You know, we have it to a degree with Junior Davis Cup, Junior Billie Jean King Cup. But I think you're spot on for that. How do we really foster that ongoing team environment? And so the USTA has a unique opportunity right now because they completely blew up the model of player development. And now they're integrating it with Pro Circuit, with ITF World Tennis Tour Junior. And, you know, Tracy Davies is overseeing that. You know, when you were managing director of player development, and I remember being down in Boca, there really was a sense of team camaraderie and it was extraordinary. And I think we lost a little bit of that as well. And so hopefully that's going to come back. But look, you're right. How do we really incorporate more team competitions? But you won't get any pushback from Billie Jean King on that one. She's been talking about it forever.
No, definitely not. But it's funny when you were talking about, you know, the sort of nature of players, like even now, like in my current world, I'm, you know, 59 years old, but I like to go to my club and hit against the wall, like I used to do at the Douglasson Club. That's how I got started playing tennis. So there's that part of me that enjoys that. You know, I enjoy that, like being by myself, you know, hitting 40 minutes against the wall. And I guess that's what you talk about. I want to shift to something that you spearheaded in your years as a president, which is letting the world know that tennis is the world's healthiest sport. And I think, you know, that's continuing to gain momentum because, as you said earlier, it's about the data. So how talk a little bit about how important that was for you as the president to put that message out there.
Yeah, you know, it just, well, when I first became president, I remember the first public meeting I had, I said, look, I'm not smart enough to put out a 2-year game plan because, you know, it's kind of a dysfunctional 2-year term. You're on roller skates and you try to do whatever you can. And I said, so instead, here's my 5, 10, and 20-year plan. And that's how I'm used to thinking as a scientist. And when I saw all of the data on health benefits, if we could just shift our mission statement from, you know, promoting and developing the growth of tennis to growing tennis to inspire healthier people and communities everywhere, it's a very powerful statement. And the idea really is if tennis is that healthy, then we as an association have an obligation to make certain that tennis is readily available to everyone. So that then allowed our whole infrastructure project, because most tennis in the U.S. is played in public parks. How can we really update our public parks and make certain that tennis is available to every person of all abilities and all socioeconomic backgrounds? So that was an important part of it. You know, but also even the mental health aspect of it. There's some incredible data, especially in our kids, that when you're actively engaged in sport, this is female-specific data too, that your self-esteem is substantially higher than those who are not playing sports. And that includes tennis. So it's just, you know, the idea really was, let's get the word out that tennis is great. But it also was, let's get the word out that sport is great. Let's make tennis the model sport, but let's get everyone in this country playing sport.
Well, the old USTA, the other phrase, tennis is a sport for a lifetime. So I think you and I would be good models for that because we're still trying to go strong. I'm recovering from my shoulder surgery, my fourth, Dr. Hainline, my third on my right shoulder. But I'm hoping that this one gets me back on the courts in a couple of months. All right. So your focus now, I know you still are involved with the USTA, with the ITF as well. But it sounds like this is really what you're about, right? Is about continuing to study mental health. And where do you think this is all going? What's the next big thing that's coming?
So right after Roland Garros, there were a large group of us appointed by the International Olympic Committee. We met in Lausanne, where the IOC headquarters are, and it was our second World Summit on Mental Health and Elite Athletes. And so I'm co-chair of that summit. And we're right now putting together the final touches for what is going to be the definitive consensus paper. And so the IOC is going to much more aggressively this time around really try to socialize all aspects of that. So, you know, it'll be at the elite level, but then there really is, in this case, a trickle-down effect, which is true. And there's something in the IOC called Athlete 365. So they've really mobilized the athletes, and they've completely embraced this idea that mental health is fundamental to who we are as people in sport that are really in the business of human development and athletic development. So I think you're going to see, starting in the spring of 2026, a much more massive mobilization of all aspects of socializing how important mental health is and taking care of athletes.
I also want to ask you a little bit about pro tennis, because I get this all the time on my social media, and I'm paying attention now to what's going on as we get to the end of this tennis season for the top pros. And as often has happened for many years, you know, many of the pros say it's too long. The season is too long. Injuries, they got to cut it back. It's never happened. I'm not sure it ever will. I think the women have done a slightly better job, the WTA Tour, with ending their season a little bit earlier. But how does that, you know, the physical side of it, we know the game has gotten faster, more intense, so on and so forth. But how does that tie into what also is the mental health of the players and trying to keep the longevity of the top players so that they can continue to play at a high level for, you know, into their 30s?
Well, let me just take a little side step. You mentioned the WTA. They really, when you look at every professional sport organization in the world, they're at the front, they're at the top in terms of promoting overall wellness and mental health. I mean, under the leadership of Kathleen Stoya, they've just been exceptional. But when you look at the calendar, and there's this one word, it's the most important word in all of sport. It's called periodization. And periodization means that for every amount of overreach, there must be compensatory recovery. And the overreach is physical, mental, it's social, it's spiritual even. And so you're at a place where players are on the cusp of just getting burnt out. So they can't recover, they get injured. Injuries actually predict mental health symptoms and disorders. But when you're emotionally spent, you know, you're not spending time with your friends, your loved ones, that's going to predict mental health symptoms and disorders. So you're completely right. The calendar right now, it makes no sense. And I hope that you're wrong, although, you know, I'm not so certain that you are. I don't see things changing anytime soon. You know, there was this big push to have a Premier Tour, and the Slams just couldn't get agreements with the tours. And so now we have this, you know, basically January to December kind of schedule. So it's not healthy. It's not good for mental health, not good for physical health. It's not good for spiritual health.
And I guess it's up to the players, you know, as individuals, to make those assessments. And, you know, for someone like me who was, you know, more of a journeyman player, I think it's even more difficult because, you know, you got to keep playing to make money. It's if you're a top player, you have a little more ability to pick and choose. And I think that's part of the reason why Roger and Serena and Rafa and now Novak still going are able to play so long, because they kind of figured it out that you have to, in my view, take matters into your own hands. Because if you're waiting for the tours to change up the overall schedule, you'll be waiting a while.
Yeah. And so what they figured out really is the magic of recovery. And that really, again, that's the essence of periodization. And going back to your sleep comment earlier, I mean, we have to recover on a very scheduled basis, but it actually is a daily sort of thing, too.
Well, Brian, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you. I appreciate you giving us the time here at Tennis Worthy. Would you like to leave us with one closing wrap-up thought on overall mental health in our great sport of tennis?
I would just end it by saying that we have to put mental health in the same realm of physical health. They're really inseparable, but let's treat any mental health symptom like we would treat an ankle sprain, and then we'll be on the right path if we do that.
Well, we appreciate putting us all on the right path, and keep hitting those courts at the Douglaston Club, and think of me when you walk past that wall on the hard court. That's where, as a three-year-old, I took my tricycle down there. That's where I started playing tennis.
Yeah, It's a great wall, still kind of a little crooked too, but that you know, it helps your reflexes.
That helps your reflexes and your ability to adjust. Dr. Brian Hainline here joining us on the Tennis Worthy podcast. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, Patrick.